Welcome to the 72nd episode of Reverse Threat Radio. I'm Andy Ryan.
And I'm Toby Chad.
Welcome to the podcast that has now endured longer than Michael Clarke's Australian captaincy.
Yes, here at Reverse Threat Radio, we try not to talk about the well-worn topics in the news. But of course, we are going to be talking about the Ashes because we are English. And because this is the first podcast since that really rather wonderful test at Trent Bridge, and obviously us winning the Ashes. And we're also going to be talking the second part of our history of Australia's Indigenous cricketers, and we're going to be reviewing a brilliant biography of another troubled Australian captain, Kim Hughes. But before we get there, Andy, tell me about your cricketing life over the last few weeks since we last recorded.
So last Saturday, I had the exciting challenge of taking my girlfriend Laura to her first ever cricket game, Middlesex Sussex at Lord's. This was at her own request. She wasn't being forced to go. And it's a great reminder to those of us who are real cricket addicts and, you know, live by all the complicated language within the game. Try explaining the game to someone who has never encountered it at all. Everything is deeply complex. So try explaining the different types of bowlers. You start by saying, some are fast, some are slow, some swing the ball, some spin the ball. Hang on, what's the difference between swing and spin? They both involve movement of the ball. And very soon you get caught up in this web of vocabulary that often seems just insufficient for describing what you're trying to describe.
Now, a couple of summers ago, I took a friend to Lord's for the first time that she had ever watched a game of cricket. And I actually found it a really bad way to introduce someone to cricket, to go to a live game. Because when you say, you explain what swing is, you can't actually see the ball swinging from a distance. You don't have any replays or anything. Did you find that a problem?
Well, I think there were two things, really. So firstly, it was a great reminder to me that actually we shouldn't be ashamed of how complicated cricket is. That's its beauty, really. The nuance of the game is in that complexity. It's the fact that nothing is actually straightforward. But also, I wonder if there's any other sport that can be enjoyed as much as cricket, even when you have no knowledge of the game at all. So Laura did make a pretty determined effort to engage with what was going on, but also was very, very content to sit there in the glorious setting of Lord's in the sun and enjoy, you know, a drink and a bit of a picnic. And I thought, well, actually, maybe this is one of the other wonderful things about cricket, that actually you go along with no knowledge of it at all and can actually have a pretty good time anyway.
Totally. Now, while you've been sunning yourself at Lord's and watching your cricket there, most of my cricket has been watched in bars in the middle of the night or huddled under the bedclothes listening to Test Match Special on the radio, which thankfully in Australia is broadcast on the ABC, because of course the last couple of weeks have been very fine ones to be a fan of English cricket, and particularly to be a fan of English cricket in Australia. And I've been very nice to all of my Australian friends. And of course, when I've seen them, I've said to them, don't worry, I'm not going to talk about the cricket. And of course, we end up always talking about the cricket. But one really interesting thing that's come out of it, actually, and one really interesting thing that's come out in the Australian media more broadly, has, you know, whenever Australia loses sports, you know, it's a national tragedy. And they basically set up inquiries into why we're so awful and, you know, overhaul the education system and everything else. They get pretty bloody het up when, sorry, I don't know if I'm allowed to say that on a family-friendly podcast, but anyway, I didn't really say that. But they get pretty het up when their teams don't win. And actually, what's been really interesting is that now women's cricket has just become the national sport. Women's cricket and actually netball, because the Australians are doing quite well in netball, I think, at the moment. And so whenever I end up talking to someone about the cricket, they always end up saying, ah, yes, but have you seen how we're doing in the women's Ashes? And of course, yesterday they won the one and only test in the Ashes series. So actually, inadvertently, humiliation for the men's team has turned into a good thing for the Australian women's team. And, well, that is a good thing, I think.
It's a wonderful example of an accidental way of promoting equality of the two sports, isn't it? Because a very similar thing's happened, I think, with English football, where the English women's team went and did very well in the World Cup. And suddenly, you know, much better than the English men have done recently, suddenly a lot of people got behind that. So, yes, I suppose that is something you could give to Michael Clarke, that his team's failures have actually done wonders for gender equality in Australian sport. But back to Trent Bridge. Were you able to follow that test successfully from the other side of the planet.
Well, do you know what? A lot of it I watched. I remember on the Friday, which is when Stuart Broad was no, the Thursday Stuart Broad was taking all the wickets. I left the office at just as play was starting, and I got on the bus about 10 minutes later, and looked at my phone to see what the score was. I was going home, and it was about 7:30 in the evening here. And of course, by that point, 3 wickets had fallen. And anyway, I got back here and I watched it until as late as I humanly could, given that I had to go to work the next morning. The most annoying thing is that when we won the Ashes on that morning, I was at a concert, and there I was, and I was refreshing busily in between each song that was playing. But it was enormous frustration to be there when I just wanted to, you know, and obviously the people who were there in the concert as well weren't particularly interested in cricket. And I just wanted to be, you know, cheering essentially and watching it and participating in it. And there I was kind of hiding my phone under my jacket, you know, with the kind of brightness of the screen turned down so no one could see.
Because there's a strange symbolism in there. You want to share that moment, don't you? Even though you know the victory's coming, you kind of want to be watching or want to be listening at that very moment when the Ashes
absolutely,
are regained.
Particularly because it seemed as if it was a very, very emotional victory as well. You know, everyone was crying all over the shop, as far as I could tell, when there were all the victory speeches. Alistair Cook was crying and Michael Clarke was crying, and everyone sort of got very into it. So, no, it was that was unfortunate to be a bit distant from it, but from what you were saying earlier, it sounds as if the even the English media was slightly distant from the victory in a bizarre way as well.
Well, it's a constant gripe of mine that the distinction between the cricket season and the football season has blurred more and more over the last few years, and this year it has got to truly ridiculous levels. So the football season this year began on August the 8th. It's partly as a result of international competitions that are going on in next year, so they've had to shift the whole season forward. But it was ridiculous that on the day that England regained the Ashes, the BBC Sports website top headline was actually about the new day of the season. And what's so unfortunate, I think, about this is that for a long, long time, that there's no need for competition between sports to be a zero-sum game. They can all flourish. They just need to respect their seasons. And to me, it is utterly obvious that August could be allowed. August should just be, it is a cricket's time of year. It should be given that sort of front page attention.
When does the football season actually start? Sorry, I don't really follow football.
Well,
so
it began last Saturday for the season.
Oh, so
began
it actually
last
began,
Saturday.
Oh, right, the so they weren't yeah. just kind of actually, it actually began last Saturday.
No, and I think obviously there's a lot of people like myself who very much enjoy both sports, and it just ends up being a bit frustrating actually, because you kind of want to dedicate your attention maybe more to one than the other, and I guess it comes down to cricket has already struggled with the suffocation of media attention from not being on terrestrial TV anymore, and this is just another blow. And you know, the really sad thing is, it doesn't look like we're going to be getting the hype of open top bus parades and everything this time, despite this being a really talented group of England players who've won this series as underdogs, and they deserve that hype. From the archives, and in this episode, Toby is going to continue with the second part of his feature on Australia's Indigenous cricketers.
So in the last episode of Reverse Web Radio, we talked about the first ever Australian tour to England, which happened in 1868, and which remarkably featured a team made up entirely of Indigenous Australians. And we explored a bit about how Indigenous Australian cricket had developed up to that point to be, you know, a reasonably flourishing and thriving scene. And we also talked about some of the slightly more uncomfortable questions that surround Indigenous cricket and the level of consent of those cricketers to be taken to the other side of the world and set up in what was essentially a bit of a series of circus games. But whatever the case around those kind of ethical issues, the fact is that at the end of the 19th century, cricket was being played to quite a high level by you know, a significant number of the Indigenous population. And you actually think that the future for this, you know, distinctively English and colonial game could have been quite bright within the first Australians. If you then fast forward 150 years to the current day, you sort of realise that things, that promise really didn't sort of turn out well. To this day, Jason Gillespie is the only Indigenous Australian ever to have played Test cricket. And only 5 Indigenous Australians have ever even played first-class cricket ever again. And so in this in this podcast, I really want to explore sort of what went wrong in those 150 years. Interestingly, at first things looked really rosy, and actually the first Australian side to be called the Invincibles weren't Don Bradman's side in the 1950s, but were an Indigenous team from Western Australia in the 1870s. And basically they spent about 4 years being completely undefeated. What happened to this team, the Invincibles, is really sort of in a microcosm what happened to Indigenous cricketers across Australia over much of the next century, really, which is that ultimately it was sort of official structures that just drove them out of a game. So actually the West Australian Cricket Association was formed at the end of the 19th century, and when that was formed they just did not include this team, which meant that they were just completely starved of opposition, and without anyone to play against they just ceased to exist.
Now, what I find strange about this is they have obviously played a large number of, white teams. So those teams have got comfortable playing against them and are happy to play against them. And yet they're not allowed to be part of an official organisation. Can you sort of shed any light on that? Or what do you think thinking was behind?
Well, I think official policy, there are always a lot of... And I think this is sort of true in many cases, where official policy always has to be much more black and white than people's actual experiences and people's, perhaps open-mindedness towards this kind of thing. When it came to be sort of enshrined in law, and as cricket became to be, more and more formalised, then it became more political, and then therefore it had to become more explicit, and, real battle lines were drawn. And actually, there were more, explicit official decrees that happened at the beginning of the 1900s, where there was a law that was passed which meant that effectively Indigenous Australians could not make any profit ever. So they were only allowed to keep the money that they directly then paid out in rent or expenses of some sort. They couldn't have spare cash, and it was a way basically of just making sure that the Indigenous population was really under the thumb of the government. And what that meant was that they didn't have any money to buy cricket gear, and there was also a law that meant that they couldn't travel. And so I think basically one of the issues was that, when you go back to that first cricket team that toured England, that was just an enterprising individual who decided that this is something we're going to do. But when the government came along, and there was this White Australia policy that was a policy for a long time, which was effectively an apartheid, that basically said, Australians are the white settlers, the Indigenous Australians aren't really Australians.
I guess what's disappointing about this is that there's often been this idea that sport can be a great promoter of equality, so that actually you play on the same field as someone from a different background than you, and that can change your perception. But I guess this is quite a sad example where actually, despite in that mid-19th century playing with a lot of white teams, and as you say, even touring England, it's clear that that had no real impact. Maybe it changed how some of the individuals they played against felt, but obviously had no impact on the thinking of those in power, those in command. Mm-hmm. Because actually, I guess it is quite, if you're trying to promote, as you say, a policy of basically apartheid, it is clearly quite threatening to that policy to see those people sharing a field.
It is. Exactly, and you see it in the West Indies as well, with the independence movement in the West Indies, the really meaningful way in which cricket entered that power struggle, which was basically this thing of, well, you've taught us this game and now we're better at it than you are. Why, on what basis are you our overlords effectively? But what's interesting is that in women's cricket, where it was less in the limelight, it was less of a political statement if you had Indigenous cricketers playing in it, actually there were greater strides made in terms of having Indigenous cricketers play representative cricket. And it's not huge. There were in the 1930s there were a couple of cousins from Stradbroke Island, which is up in northeastern Australia, who represented Queensland against an English touring side. And then in 1958, Faith Thomas who was an Indigenous woman, became the first Indigenous woman to play for Australia in any sport, and the first Indigenous man or woman to turn out for Australia in Test cricket when she played in some games against New Zealand and England. But what's interesting is that the Indigenous population did carry on playing cricket, and there were some remarkable cricketers who came out of the Indigenous population as well. When I was researching this piece, I was staggered to find that there are three fast bowlers who are, you know, widely acknowledged by the people who they came up against, who included Don Bradman and Victor Trumper, to have been the greatest fast bowlers that, that Australia has ever produced during that kind of golden era in the 30s. And they were, the three of them were Jack Marsh, Albert Henry and Eddie Gilbert. Have we ever heard of them? Of course we've never heard of them. And essentially that was because the whilst people were willing to play against them, you know, Don Bradman played against all three of these. Famously, he was bowled by Eddie Gilbert. But actually, it was the racism of the umpires and the game that sort of hounded them out. So they all got called, they were all fast bowlers, and they all got called for chucking consistently. And Jack Marsh went to the extent of proving that he could bowl his fastest ball with his arm straight by putting his arm into, by strapping two bits of wood both sides of his arm so that his arm actually physically couldn't bend, and then he could still bowl at top speed. So he was proving that it was possible, and they still called him for no balls.
I think what's exceptionally sad about that is obviously the discrimination in all forms is sad, but when it's done officially and the players even aren't even allowed to participate, that's one thing. To allow them to participate and then discriminate against them in the game, you know, to not allow them to play the game in the same way as the others, even when it is really is grim. And I think it also makes you realise that actually you're in that situation, you're putting the umpires, who are, you know, supposed to be the enforcers and fair enforcers of the rules of the game, almost to do the officials' dirty work for them. It's quite,
yeah,
it's a really unpleasant, an unpleasant story.
And what's sort of in a way particularly nasty about it, but also particularly distinguishes it from apartheid in South Africa, for instance, is that it was never explicit. It was never, no, you are indigenous and therefore you cannot play against us. There were all of these kind of secondary means of making sure that they couldn't play, calling them for no balls, you know, taking away any money that they might have to buy kit, making it impossible for them to travel. Even when, in the case of Marsh, when he was, because he was renowned as being a fantastic cricketer, and everyone was clamoring for him to tour with the Australian team to England, but this was just, you know, this was seen as being by the authorities as being something that was completely unthinkable, and so they blocked it. But of course they never blocked it because he was indigenous. They never officially said that. It was always because they said, oh, because his action isn't right.
The interesting thing is that obviously when it's an official mandate, an official policy, it's much easier to rally clear opposition to it.
Exactly.
I think when it's a bit more nebulous, when it's this slightly vague, sort of more manipulative discrimination, it's kind of harder to oppose. So there is strategy behind that.
Mm-mm-mm. Now, one of the really sad things about this story is that I think it there is lasting damage. And it's something that the cricketing community in Australia has never really recovered from. One of the big issues is that there are now basically no role models playing cricket, and no established, who are indigenous, and no established routes for indigenous cricketers to play cricket at the highest level. You know, there are a few things that happened in 1998. There was a program launched in Queensland in memory of Eddie Gilbert, who was one of those brilliant fast bowlers, to encourage cricket. In 1988, 10 years before, there was a an all-Indigenous team that toured to the UK to mark, ironically, to mark the bicentennial of Captain Cook's landing in Australia, the worst thing that ever happened for the Indigenous people of Australia. There's a national Indigenous cricket competition that's held in Alice Springs. But of the 1 million people in Australia who regularly play cricket, just 1.6% are Indigenous. And the, you know, the real sort of enormity or lack of enormity of that figure is shown by the fact that Aussie Rules AFL, 9% of the people who play are Indigenous. The AFL punches above its weight. Cricket clearly has a long, long way to go. But I think there is, you know, this real entrenched historical reason is at the heart of you know, an enormous problem, an enormous sort of tragedy of Australian cricket.
I wonder if there's any possibility that Australian cricket, almost selfishness, the desire to just make the team better, might lead to a desire to really push cricket in the Indigenous community. So, for example, you're not pushing cricket just because you think it's important to spread the game. You're pushing cricket because actually you want access to all the best players, potentially. Do you think there's any evidence of that sort of line of thinking amongst the Australian cricket authorities?
Not that I've seen. I think the issue is that because there just isn't all that much infrastructure within Indigenous communities for people to play cricket, that it's sort of there just aren't very many really significant cricketers who are coming out of those communities, and Australian cricket is fed by a really, really well-established route of people who come through certain schools. So the review, and for this episode we have been reading Golden Boy, Kim Hughes and the Bad Old Days of Australian Cricket by Christian Ryan. Christian Ryan, who I have to say was new to me, he lives in Melbourne, he writes and edits and is a former editor of the Monthly and Wisden Cricketers Almanac Australia. As a boy, he watched Kim Hughes hit hundreds at the Wacker. That's his official little blurb on the back of the book. Now, I've been carrying this book around with me for the last week, and a couple of people have seen it in my hands, one of whom I work with, who is a lady in her late 40s, and she looks at it and she said, "Oh, Kim Hughes, he was wonderful, but my God, didn't they treat him badly." And then yesterday evening I was at dinner and someone said to me, with some friends, and someone said to me, "What are you reading at the moment?" And I said, "Oh, I'm reading a book about Kim Hughes, who I never really knew much about." And again, her eyes, lit up. And she said, "Oh, Kim Hughes, the wonderful Kim Hughes, what a tragedy." Now, how much did you know about Kim Hughes before you read this book?
Not a huge amount. Funnily enough, when I saw some of the photos in the book, they were instantly recognisable from them. So, and he is obviously, the way he used to play was incredibly photogenic. He would play these extraordinary shots, and that was captured on film. But I didn't know. And what I found very interesting about what you've just said is that this idea of him as a tragic figure is obviously very prominent in Australia, because these are people you're talking to who presumably aren't cricket nuts. They're just sort of people who are interested in Australia generally, who that idea of him as this tragic figurehead is obviously pretty prominent in Australia.
It's entered the popular consciousness. So just for those listeners who aren't entirely familiar with Kim Hughes, because I suggest actually there may be a fair few. Here's my 30-second Potter biography, probably going to be riddled with inaccuracies and leaving something out, but essentially he's a West Australian cricketer, and he was really playing at the began his life at when World Series cricket was happening in the Packer Revolution, which he turned down, didn't play, started playing for Australia, fell out essentially very much, particularly with Dennis Lilly and Rodney Marsh. He became captain. He was captain for the infamous Ashes in England in 1981, Botham's Ashes, which he of course lost, played a stunning innings against the West Indies, 100 that won against the West Indies. It then all went horribly wrong and he ended up resigning in tears. Is that a good Potter biography of his life? Don't read the book, it's 400 pages, and I've just given it to you in 30 seconds.
Yeah, it's not bad. I think it was, as a batsman, there was a sense very early on in his career that he was something special, and lots of people saw him and said, actually, we may have the Australian Viv Richards on our hands. He was actually, in terms of his range of attacking shots, a batsman before his time. And it seems like a slightly ridiculous thing to say, but he genuinely seemed to have been cursed by having too much talent. He could play shots that others couldn't play to balls that, outstandingly good bowling. And it was almost as if he felt impelled to play those shots. He saw batting in terms of imposing himself on the bowlers, and also, and this makes him a very modern batsman, he talked about entertaining. He talked about giving people that special hour, that enjoyable hour of entertainment. And he never really changed that mentality. And a lot of people feel like the 37 average that he ended up with Test cricket was, as a result, not a reflection of the ability he had.
And one of the great things I think about this book is that, and one of the really this book is, it brings out a lot of the kind of central paradoxes around. And one of them, I think, is here is this man who, at the very beginning of his career, there's this whole question about whether he was actually ever invited to play in World Series cricket, or whether he just claimed he was invited but he wasn't, and these kind of things. But he came out very much against World Series cricket, which was exactly this thing that was based around the idea of entertainment. And Kim Hughes got out time and time again in the 90s, because he always had this attitude that you're there to entertain. Of course you have to bring out your 100 with a six. And so, of course, he lost out on more hundreds than he had. I think one of the themes throughout this book is this real paradox, the man. And I think the real paradox comes out particularly around his captaincy.
So I think it's very rare for someone, and Ryan makes this point in the book, for someone to really dream obsessively about being a captain. I guess lots of young players dream of playing for their national team, but it's probably a lot rarer to dream of being a captain, and that was very much Hughes' thing. He always wanted to lead. And from the book, it's quite clear that actually Rod Marsh was the better thinker. He was the more natural captain in that sense, and that's in no way to justify, I think, the way he behaved towards Hughes. But that was clear, and I think there is inherently something quite sad in someone having this ultimate dream, getting that position, achieving that dream, and then finding themselves lacking. He clearly didn't have the natural tactical nous, and actually, despite being a very open-hearted player, did seem to have a bit of a naivety in the way he managed others and sort of managed other people.
He didn't have the tactical knack. He had a certain naivety, and he fundamentally had two players who were pivotal to the team, who basically wanted him to fail at every single opportunity, even if it meant them, being part of a failing team. And they were Rod Marsh and Dennis Lillee. The book actually is just how much, and Kim Hughes was playing 30 years ago. This isn't prehistoric, but how far the game of cricket has changed since he was playing. Very early on in the book, there's an anecdote about his father, who was a school teacher, who when he was he went into work in a new school, and he saw these two boys who he thought were going to give him trouble, and he just beat them up, basically. He beat them black and blue, and these boys never gave him trouble again. And you suddenly think, hang on, this wasn't all that long ago. Beating up your school children as a teacher really isn't a done thing. And also that sense of, the past being a foreign country comes across with the whole Rodney Marsh and Dennis Lillee thing, where they were coming out explicitly talking to the press when they were on the pitch. They would just disobey him. There's an extraordinary interview Rodney Marsh does with none other than Playboy during the time that Marsh, he refused to be vice captain to Kim Hughes. And during the time that Hughes was captain and Rod Marsh was playing, Marsh came out and did this interview and basically said, "I've always said I will play under anyone, and I will happily have anyone as my captain, but Kim Hughes is just not that person. Basically, I cannot think of anyone worse to be captain."
In particular, the coach, the strong coach that you now have in international cricket, is completely absent. And Christian Ryan interviews a lot of the people who oversaw these tours. And what comes across again and again is their sense of total powerlessness. They could see how brutally Hughes was being undermined, but they couldn't do anything about it. The book is a lot, in a lot of ways, a study of a view of masculinity that a lot of these Australian cricketers had, and they sort of saw it that you're Australian captain, you have to take what's thrown at you. And a lot, several people make the case that they sort of say, okay, Hughes was horribly treated by a lot of players, but really toughen up, that's what you've got to do. But you can't help thinking that actually, is there anything less masculine or anything less courageous than sniping openly against your fellow teammate? I mean, things like, for example, open disobedience in the middle of a game, on the middle, you think actually that seems to be a deeply cowardly thing to do.
And particularly these extraordinary accounts of Dennis Lillee going into the nets when he was on the same side as Kim Hughes, and just bowling bouncer after bouncer after bouncer at his head, and Hughes kind of soaking it up, and occasionally getting hit and occasionally not. But the morning before an important test match, Lillee would just go in kind of with the view that he'd sort of want to kill him. What I think you're right that this kind of studies of sort of masculinity in inverted commas and weakness in inverted commas are very central to the book. Do you see it as a problem for this book, for this biography? That so Kim Hughes has never written a biography. He always said after he tearfully resigned the captaincy, there was sort of a promise that he'd write an autobiography. It's just never happened. And when Christian Ryan went to him and said, "I'm going to write this book," Kim Hughes said, "Good luck to you, but I do not want to have anything to do with it." And Kim Hughes basically forbade anyone who he had any influence over from talking to Christian Ryan about this book. Dennis Lillee also never talked to him. Rodney Marsh also never talked to him. Do you see that as a disadvantage for this book, that all of those key people weren't directly interviewed and participated in it?
It should be, but amazingly, it doesn't seem to be. In that Ryan's research is so dedicated and so diligent that he manages to build the picture from other accounts. I think what's what's wonderful about it is that there's a sense that there's a kind of moral purpose to the whole book. Ryan feels like he's righting a wrong, and the fact that he clearly deeply enamored with Hughes as a player and as a man means this is quite a personal biography. I think it's quite personally written, and I think I was saying to you actually before we got on air, we often think of sports writing, cricket writing, can be a bit superficial, you know, at the end of the day it's just a sport, isn't it? But actually this was a book that at times I would challenge anyone who read it not to feel deeply, deeply sad. There are many points in this book where you're seeing a very honest and good man being treated appallingly. But I think amongst the sadness that there are, it's important to remember that I think Hughes did leave in his own way quite a special legacy. I think there are a string of extraordinary innings. The one that struck me most, and the one that is just brilliantly described by Ryan, is this unbeaten 100 against West Indies at the MCG in 81. And this is West Indies in their prime, and Australia as a whole were dismissed for 170, 180 odd, and Hughes made an unbeaten 100. And you have him fearlessly walking down the crease to these astonishing pace bowlers, hooking endless bounces off his nose, and you think, God, this is thrilling, thrilling stuff. And even
the
actually,
highlights are on YouTube, you know. I looked that up this afternoon.
Well, and Greg Chappell actually, I see, introduces one of the YouTube highlights and actually says that even despite, you know, the disagreements they've had, he describes it as the greatest post-war Australian innings. So,
Oh, there we
for
go.
all that Hughes didn't achieve, there is plenty of legacy still there.
So this is Christian Ryan's book, Golden Boy, Kim Hughes and the Bad Old Days of Australian Cricket. It's published by Allen and Unwin and comes with our hearty recommendation, I think it's fair to say.